Welcome to Rooster Radio. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. This episode is syndicated with our sports podcast show, Off Field. We're continuing our epic two-hour interview with Geelong Premiership coach Chris Scott. In part one, Chris talked in detail about the volatile world of coaching and his rapid rise to the top. If you missed it, make sure you go back and have a listen. Now, in part two, Chris goes deep into the topic of high performance, from the perspective of overseeing an elite team, but also on a personal level. Chris is a dad, and each of his fellow coaches at Geelong have three or more kids. So despite holding one of the most demanding jobs, Chris strives for balance, not just for himself, but also those around him. He's obsessed with high performance, but tries not to be blinded by it, which is something he's had to get better at. Chris believes that going too far can lead to poor decision-making and exhausted, unhappy teams. Chris is a very private person and admits to struggling with the public nature of his job. He says this is one of the big challenges facing young sports stars who are putting themselves on the market. He also talks about his influences, including family, other leaders, books, and podcasts. There's so many insights here with great detail, stories, and examples from Chris. Now enjoy part two of our interview with Chris Scott. Outside of the club system in terms of training and the things that you do as part of the program, do you personally have what I would call high-performance habits? So things that you personally do to make sure that you're at your peak or you know, a way of learning or things that are, I guess, a part of your personal process?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I don't talk about it too often publicly. Is this a public forum? It's probably
no,
pretty clear.
We have about two listeners.
Yeah, right. I was going to ask what your listenership is.
No, we don't talk about that.
Anyway. Yeah.
No, it's all good.
It's evolving and I think it's really important that I keep evolving, that I don't sort of get set on a process that I think works and then stick to it, you know, in a bloody-minded fashion. Right at the moment, there's a clear system that we work through, and in season's easiest because it's, you know, the week is bookended by games and you work through a review process. We try, in principle, to try to use our reviews to look forward, which sounds like an oxymoron, I know, but we're not looking to dissect the game, to work out exactly what happened in that game the way some people might analyse it. We're looking for the cues from that game that need to influence what we're going to do the following week and in 4 weeks' time. So hopefully that the learning process is just a continually progressive process. So if I ignore all those sort of boring parts, you know, the cycle of the week, it's obvious. Every club has it. You review, then you train, try to implement a few things, look at the opposition, prepare for the next game. On a personal level, the process now is more about trying to find opportunities to step back and, you know, see the forest again. Sometimes you do miss the forest for the trees when you're stuck in the day-to-day. And don't get me wrong, as I said earlier, the head coach, in my opinion, has to be across stuff. You can't say, oh, you know, we're not defending very well, but talk to Matty Scarlett, he's the defensive coach. You've got to be across the nitty-gritty to an extent. The way they play at least has to be signed off by me. And that doesn't mean I'll get everything that I want, but it does mean that if we go with something that's different to what I initially put forward, it's got to be better. So you've got to cultivate a process with your assistant coaches in particular where you sit around and the best idea wins. And that's really, really difficult, I imagine, for a young assistant coach if you've got a really big, strong, charismatic personality as a head coach who's also autocratic. I tend to think that even if they've got the best idea, they'll rarely win the debate. So that part of cultivating that free space is about leaving it, and this is a challenge for me because, as you can probably tell from this podcast, when I get onto something I'm passionate about, I can talk a bit. So part of my performance review is just try to find the room for them to feel comfortable putting things forward. And again, like, the off season was really good for me because that's sort of one of the takeaways that I got listening to other people and reading books. Like, the objective data is really important, and thinking about things, even though your blink moment is to disregard it, is still really valuable. You can still, over, you know, the fullness of time, go back and say, I knew my instinct was right and we're not going to do that, or we are going to do it. But the process you work through to try to validate that decision-making, I think, is really important. And assistant coaches who are experts in their field are a great resource for that.
I'm going to point you even further into this.
Can we turn the heater up, by the way?
Yeah. It is a hot day in Adelaide and we don't have the air conditioning on. So this will be
good. They don't turn it on weekends, and I'm not even joking.
No. This is a loaded question, because I think I know the answer. We do ask people, what's your morning routine? You know, a lot of people we know who've spoken here get up.
And this is us getting a bit Tim Ferriss.
Yeah, a bit Tim Ferriss. They meditate and they need to be in water, and then they diarise their thoughts, and then they can attack the day with, in all honesty, what is a routine for you? How do you get by every day, which is full on?
So you want me to say that I get up at 4:45, immerse myself in 5-degree water for half an hour while I enjoy
the performance, isn't it?
This is what you do. The Wim Hof method, and then meditate. I can't even sit cross-legged on the floor. I'm so stiff. So there are aspects of all those things that make so much sense. And occasionally when I do them, I get great benefits. But the reality of life kicks in too much. So this is, I'll give you the real answer, and then probably try to add on a few bits that I'm trying to change. So one thing that some people might find interesting, is that our coaching group, almost to a man, have a minimum of 3 kids. So, and three of them have 4, and young kids too. So, the 2 families with 4 kids, I think the eldest is 12 or 13. But they have a fantastic work ethic, our guys. And it took me a while to realise that they got in really, really early, because I didn't have any kids when I started at Geelong. Now we've got a little girl who's almost 4, but it took me a long time to realise that it's pretty crazy in the morning at
home. If you
can
skip that morning routine, yeah, it's pretty
handy. That explains Andrew, like, banging on about getting into work.
Yeah, I'm out of there. Bang. Sorry.
Yeah, it's kind of like, which one's harder?
Yeah.
I'd counter sometimes staying at home a little bit later might be harder. But for me, I decided really early on when we had Layla, our little girl, that if I could avoid it, I was not going to be the father who went to work before she woke up and got home just as she was going to bed, or got home just as she was in the foul mood, which a lot of toddlers are, you know, around that time. So the best workflow for me, and it doesn't suit all our coaches, but again, I think we've worked to the point where they just find their workaround. And if they're in at 7 and I'm not in till 9 some days, they don't sit there for 2 hours waiting to be told what to do. So most of the time I get up relatively early, depends how many reds I've had the night before, and try to have at least half an hour, 45 minutes before Layla wakes up. So a lot of the time, in all honesty, I'd like to say that it's just clear space and I just, you know, contemplate the world, but a lot of the time there's some cramming to get stuff ready for the day. Yeah, so, and I, you know, it's not a formal meditation process, but the first couple of coffees, especially the second one in the morning, and I will admit to a bit of a caffeine addiction, I run to the coffee machine at 6:15. But that first or second coffee, just sort of flicking through what I consider to be interesting, preferably with no not even 1 degree's separation from footy, is a good time to just, and it's amazing how often, I think most people are the same in this respect, when you're really mulling over something and trying to come to terms with a difficult decision, it's amazing how when you think about something completely different, I think this is one of the fundamental positives in that idea of mindfulness or meditation. If you can actually clear your mind, or at least think about something completely unrelated, it becomes a bit clearer to you. So often that time is time by myself. And then Layla wakes up and I just, you know, it doesn't happen all the time. Sarah might listen to this and say, might I swear on this program?
Yeah.
That's bullshit. You don't do that. But I try to just spend a bit of time with her. You know, and she's going through a phase at the moment where some morning she wakes up and she says, I don't like you, Daddy. And I said, well, too bad. I'm still going to hang around for half an hour and be in your face for a bit. What else do I do? The preparation for the day is relatively important. I do more. I talked about my workflow changing. I used to do a lot of work at the club. And unfortunately, that used to involve a lot of work before people came or after they left, because when you're there, most people just want FaceTime with you. And that's crucial. I went through a really bad phase on reflection where I just closed my door during the day because otherwise I didn't get stuff done. You know, and that's kind of going against every sort of leadership management rule in the book to kind of shut people off. Although I think they're comfortable enough to knock on the door if they want to see me. That's okay. But, preferably when you're there, you're available. And that's something our GM of footy, Steve Hocking, does so well. He's just always available for people when they need it. And that means his day is a little bit more inefficient, but he would argue that's the most important stuff. So the workflow's changed. So I do a bit of work at home because when you walk into the club, you tend to be bombarded a little bit. So there's a degree of organisation there. And what else would I do in the morning? I mean, again, I'd love to say that, you know, I punch out an hour in the gym. That's sort of my perfect world. But depending on how my back's feeling or my motivation levels or the time, which is probably the biggest thing, that often gets postponed till the afternoon if it happens at all.
I like hearing the honest answer. I think it's probably far more common at this level than what people probably think. Performance. I'm thinking about it. Just about everything that you do involves kind of trying to improve performance or performing or executing, whether it's playing golf to relax, whether it's your work, which is, you know, got real performance elements to it. I mean, are you obsessed with performance, generally speaking?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, and I think you have to be if you want to succeed in what I'm trying to do at the moment. But hopefully, come down to semantics a little bit, but I draw the distinction between being obsessed in a positive way and just being blinded by it, you know. And what I mean by that is getting so entrenched in what you're doing at the expense of everything else in your life. And I admit I haven't always been like that. I have sort of crossed the boundary, I think, into this is all that matters to me. Not for long, but just it's probably sort of oscillating in and out of, you know, that sort of frame of mind. Never to the point where, you know, you'd break the rules, stuff like that, but it's more just I did go through a phase where I thought the best thing I can do for my life and my family is to just sacrifice everything right now to play the long game. And now I'm much more of the view that balance, again, you know, that word means different things to different people, but having a bit more perspective and a bit more room for other things in your life leads to better performance. So the best example that I could use is the way we try to approach our program with our players. So I don't think I'm giving away too much here, but stop me if I'm talking for too long on this.
This is the whole point. Love it.
Okay. I'm of the view that somewhere along the lines, professional footy in Australia changed from this idea that, well, the players are, you know, part-time and they've got to work a job and they need a bit of balance in their life. Footy's not the most important thing, to professional before we even realised. And I think some clubs, you know, even ours to an extent, kind of woke up one day and said, hang on, these guys aren't doing anything else. They're getting paid unbelievably well for the most part, not all of them, but a lot of them are. And they're not working, at least in terms of contact hours, the same way that the executive is in big business. We've got to get our pound of flesh here, which to me is just completely the wrong approach. But if you're talking about performance, surely you're looking for the outcome. So if you can get that done really efficiently in a short period of time, more the better. If you can do it while still spending time with your family and cultivating some interests outside of footy, then surely that's a better thing as well. And that idea that it doesn't come down to how many hours you work, equaling how successful you're going to be. There's a base level of application and work ethic that is required no matter what you do. I completely understand that. But getting a pound of flesh at the expense of, you know, what's really important, which is the outcome you're after, just doesn't make any sense. So we try to leave enough room in our program for players to do extra work if they need to do it, which we think helps self-starters. So if there's no room to do it, you just continually do what you're told. I'll wait for the coach to tell me to do something before I do it. If there's enough space there, they think, well, okay, I'm not quite getting enough skill work here, so I'll go and do it myself. Now, with the young ones, they need some direction. In my experience, once you're 4 or 5 years in the program, if you choose not to do that stuff, you end up out of the program pretty quickly, because as a professional, you should have worked that stuff out. I say this a bit begs, but I'm not saying that our philosophy is right. I'm just saying it's the way we do it. We think that when you come into the club and you come into work, you go really hard. You're as efficient as possible. Let's not beat around the bush. It's not always going to be easy, and sometimes you're not going to like it because it's just going to be bloody hard. Although in my experience, really competitive people, they long for that really hard stuff. That's the part they enjoy the most at times. It's kind of that masochistic nature of competitive sport. But let's not keep them here just for the sake of it. Just because, and I think, you know, we all fight this urge as coaches, I'm sure. Like the 10 minutes before a game, you just want to tell them a little bit more. Like, get out of their way. You've done the work. They know what to do. Because the great fear as a coach is, I knew that was going to happen. I'd seen it before and I didn't tell them. But if you tell them everything you've seen, they're just going to go out there so confused because, you know, there's so much possibility out. Well, yeah, you can forewarn the players about what an opposition team might do, for example. But if you want it to be absolutely comprehensive, gee, you'd be there for a long time because there are so many possibilities.
So in practice, are you looking at training programs and, you know, even the little details and thinking, okay, what's minimum time, maximum output?
To an extent. The efficiency is certainly part of it. But there are parts that are deliberately inefficient because the alternative would lead to a poor outcome. So I'll give the example of, say, a session or a day where you've got a skill session, a football session, and a strength session in the one day, which is regular, in-season and pre-season. The most efficient thing would be to get in, knock over your skills straight away, walk straight into the gym, bang that out, get out of there. You could probably do it, you know, if you didn't worry about preparing to train and the meeting and the education stuff beforehand. You could probably knock it over in 3 hours if you really wanted to. But you'd end up with a really poor outcome. You kind of have two compromised sessions. So that day tends to be a full work day. They get in pretty early. Although at our club, we you know, it's probably my influence a little bit on what suits me, if I'm really honest. But if our players didn't want to, none of them would have to be in before 9:30 any day, ever. Now, invariably, you get half of the guys that are probably in at 8 just because that suits their workflow a little bit. But when I say they're in there early, relatively early, and they don't leave till quite late. But other days, there's a lot more space. So it's the efficiency piece is part of it, but the equation for us is more if they have a better quality of life, if they enjoy coming into the club more, if they feel like, because a fundamental part of our values is enjoying what we do, then we honestly believe that the outcome will be better. And I understand that not everyone thinks that. You know, some people think that, no, enjoying it's not the point. You know, to build resilience, you've got to smash yourself. And if you hate it, well, that's the idea. You'll be tougher at the end of the day. I completely, I'm open to that idea and I'm open to changing to that if we're convinced that that's the best way to go. But it's not where we're at right at the moment.
In terms of, again, performance, have you learned from other areas of other sports or other, you know, textbooks or industries, have you learned and then applied in your own world? How do you learn?
Yeah, it's a difficult question to give specific examples on because more it's bits and pieces from a lot of different areas that you know have been an influence, sometimes without you know being able to quantify exactly how it happens.
So that's it's a really good way of putting it. What has influenced you outside of football?
Yeah, so I relatively quickly learnt that in the postseason, formal education suits my style of learning more than, say, relationship building. And it's almost a cliche now that, you know, coaches go off to the States and learn how it's done in the NFL and that sort of stuff. And quite often that can result in an awesome tour of a gym that's worth $50 million. And it's like, wow, this is fantastic. What did you learn? They got some good stuff. You know, I didn't really talk to anyone because, let's be honest, the head coach of the NFL doesn't even know our game exists, much less the people that exist within it. But having said that, the formal education piece is quite difficult, at least in terms of further education for coaches in short form. You can go and certainly do postgraduate degrees and that sort of thing, but it's very difficult. Oh, I find it very difficult as a head coach to do that through the course of the year. So formal short courses that straddle leadership, business and hopefully some sort of relevance to sport has been the stuff that's had the biggest impact on me. A lot of the time that and other people have kind of pushed me towards different books or different people, and then I'm finding it's kind of the endless search. You know, it's once you get into that world, the more you look into it, the more you read, the more you realise, gee, I hadn't heard about that, or I don't understand that, and then you go and try to understand that better and realise that there's even more to it. So, you know, things as really simple as I've just read Michael Lewis's latest book, The Undoing Project. Just unbelievable relevance to what we do and the way we think. And I think most people would think that.
In what ways?
I mean, the premise of the book really is that it's the story of two unbelievably smart Israeli psychologists who, as much as anything, focus on the bias that humans have in certain decision-making processes. So humans are kind of hardwired in their view to sort of see a pattern in things that isn't necessarily there. And we're all influenced by, you know, our gut instinct and our experience. And, you know, I think our coaches are sick of me saying now that let's not rule that out just because our experience has been a negative one or because we think we've got a better way already. That there's no... It might be inefficient, but a waste of time is probably the worst you're going to get if you actually work through some of these ideas and try to prove them or get a little bit closer to proving them rather than dismissing ideas just because your gut tells you it's not right.
About talking about outside of footy influences, books, what about people and leaders? Whether you know them or you just researched and read about them, who's had a big influence or whose way of thinking has influenced you?
It's a long list. And it's funny, the person that sprung to mind first, I actually don't know that well. He was a director at Fremantle when I was an assistant coach there. He's the CEO of Wesfarmers. Now he's the chairman of the AFL Commission. I've spent a little bit of time with him. I've got an interest in the business world and I always admired the way Wesfarmers went about their business, you know, in a relatively unique way. You know, they're one of the few conglomerates in Australian big business and are happy to do it that way, even though, you know, the last, I don't know, couple of decades probably, most organisations that have run that sort of system have done their best to divest the non-core assets and they've been contrarian in that respect, and they're more of a supermarket operator now than a huge conglomerate. But they still have disparate businesses like insurance and coal mining and you know, supermarkets and you know lots of different things that don't necessarily complement each other. And the part that I admired from afar with Richard Goyder and that model in particular was the way that they empowered their people and their divisions to get the job done. And it probably goes back to that idea that if you're going to delegate and if you're going to give a division autonomy, make sure you get really good people. So if and I don't know this for a fact, but let's say Richard's strength is in finance. When he's appointing someone or when he's sort of working out who's going to run the coal business and the technical stuff on that side, get the best coal person you possibly can and then trust them to do the job. But even that's not good enough. You can't say, well, let me know when it's done. There's got to be some accountability there as well, and you've got to know enough to ask the right questions. And I can sort of see the parallel there with what I'm trying to do. I don't need to have a sports science degree necessarily. I don't need to be a physio or a doctor, but I need to have enough information and enough knowledge to ask the right questions. And then I need to do it in a way that doesn't sound like the ex-player who's now a coach who thinks they know everything about hamstring injuries. And I think, it's occasionally I do cross the line on that one. It's kind of like, the guy with 4 degrees sitting there going, how can this bloke be questioning me?
Heaven forbid someone gets a groin injury at Geelong.
Yeah, well, I feel like I know a bit about them. And yeah, if they ever listen to this, I don't know if they'll be laughing. I don't think they find it that funny, but do you know what I mean? Yeah. That idea that, and this is all about with someone that I've probably spent a combined 5 hours with, but he has been good enough to give his time a little bit. But I can see enough from afar to know that he's a leader that doesn't feel like he needs to assert himself over anyone else. He's actually quite understated. But you know that there's a wolf inside the sheep's clothing if there needs to be. And that's what I aspire to be. I don't spend too much time thinking about what people thought of me when I was a player, but I'm pretty confident that the expectation of what I am like based on what I did on the field is pretty different to the reality.
Picking up, I want a couple more.
Not just saying that because he's the head of the AFL either. We're not just after favours. I would have said that irrespective. I know he's based in Perth. I've got no other people, other influences. Sticking on the footy theme, Lee Matthews was an unbelievable influence for me. I can reel all this stuff off by rote. Because I've said it so often, but it's still really, really relevant. He was an unbelievable manager. He was probably the first manager in coaching circles as opposed to, the doer. I still think that, by today's standard, he was more involved in, the detail, what we do at kick-ins and what the stoppages look like than he might be now. But his real strength was the team dynamic and how people worked within it. He didn't, based on my observation, his strength, or he didn't value the one-on-one stuff as much. I think which it helped him not, he had this unbelievable ability to not play favourites, which, deep down, I think I could probably work out, who he liked and who he didn't. But it was a meritocracy at Brisbane. And having said that, if you've got the runs on the board and you've got his trust, he tended to back you in. And that's very much the way I coach. I'm of the view that for the most part, you're backing the players week to week, that you're confident can do it and have done it before. But then, at the end of the year, most of the time you sort of have to take the long game a little bit more. So you sort of back them until you almost can't have them on the list anymore. But that management, piece for Lee, he was about how do I tweak parts of our program to have the right impact for the overall team. And there were some people would argue there were positives and negatives with that. For example, I don't think I've ever heard him actually say it, but there was always the impression that his focus was on the 22 players that would help that week. So player number 40 on the list would probably think, I can't believe that you're loving him as much as you did, because I actually didn't get that much feedback from him. But he had a wonderful ability to work out what was really important for the team and by extension for the club, and then focus his area, his attention in on that. And it's easier these days because we have other people that can help those players get the attention they need. So the players that might not get all the focus of the head coach, but still, you know, in the performance review, you know, right down the bottom will be endeavour to spend more time one-on-one with the players.
Yeah. What is it about the business world that appeals to you?
Appeals to me in what sense?
You're interested in business. You follow, you know, the corporate world to some degree. I know that, but why do you think it's a bit of an interest of yours?
Aside from trying not to lose money in the stock market. Well, I think at its core, I'm a believer that sports people get too much exposure in society today, and the people that we consider to be brilliant at what they do are generally the ones that are exposed the most. And when you actually dig a little bit deeper, some of the smartest people, or most of the smartest people in the world, you never heard of. And that's why the technology is so good. Podcasts these days, I mean, listen to podcasts in the last 6 months about people that I'd never heard of. And they're just unbelievable stories, unbelievable. So putting aside social media and reality TV and all that sort of stuff, let's assume that that's a completely different argument altogether. Even in what you'd call the more sophisticated news of the world, the focus tends to be on a really prominent few as opposed to the really, really clever, hardworking people that are making a huge difference. And if we could add a little bit of that sophistication to what we do, we'd be much better off. I think that's the main reason. Besides losing money.
So you've spoken about overexposure. You have a public life. How do you reflect on that, and how do you perhaps create that distinction between, you know, you, your public persona, and you and who you really are, and the private person?
Yeah, I really struggle with it. Because I consider myself to be a very private person. I don't like talking about myself. I actually quite like talking about what I do. And I do think that that is public property to an extent. I quite enjoy the media stuff. I'd love to be able to do it anonymously. That's a challenge. Like, you know, there's some part of me that would like to be kind of a work in the media, under a pseudonym.
You know, James used to do that.
Oh, it doesn't surprise me.
Am I allowed to out you? And that you used to ring Jim under
from
a private name?
Yeah. Jim from Netherby. Actually, I think I have heard this before. Yeah. It doesn't surprise
me. Speed cameras in bins. Yeah. Like, just got my blood boiling.
But this is the weird thing. You're not, what's the Adelaide version? You're not ringing
Fane or.
No, you are ringing John Fane. David, you're not ringing Andrew Jarman and Graham Corns.
KG.
Or whoever it is. You're ring talking about politics and stuff like that. Can I tell you, it doesn't matter that you're a footballer talking about that stuff. Elaborate a little bit more, the balance between what I consider to be my private life and what is my obligation to the Geelong Footy Club and the industry as a whole is sometimes difficult to establish. But Geelong's been a really big help with that as well, because especially our media manager, he's very good at saying, you don't need to talk about your private life if you don't want to. But, and this is the thing I think, like, I feel sorry for the young footballers. I think this is the stuff that they're grappling with at the moment. If you decide that you're going to use the media and you're going to use your girlfriend and you're going to use your profile to promote life outside of footy or an extra revenue stream, you're kind of on the market.
Both ways.
Yeah. And I guess I do subscribe to that idea. And I'm not sure that I always live to it because, you know, there are stuff that I think there are things that blur the line. So I do some sort of stuff that's, you know, available to the public. This, for example, that's probably outside of my core role at Geelong. So it's, in some ways it's a contradiction to say I'm really private and I don't want anyone to know anything about me.
On a
which is not true anyway. I just want the people, I want it to be on my terms. I want my private life to be open to the people that are inside it. And part of that is because, you know, I didn't really talk about it when you said how did you, when the question was around how you manage, you know, the potential fallout of, you know, losing your job when you first start. One of the great sacrifices that I probably made is that, you know, I had close relationships with people that, you know, almost stopped when I got into the job. And it wasn't deliberate necessarily, but you know, Begs, you and I are friends, but, you know, we don't pick up the phone and, g'day, mate, how you going? Well, guys don't do that in general. So, you know, I was 14 years in Brisbane, 3 in Perth. Even now I sort of consider I'm back in Melbourne where I grew up, but Geelong's not Melbourne. It's an hour away. And, you know, it's actually quite difficult to maintain relationships with your friends. You know, we've got a really close group of friends that, you know, that all met in grade 5 at school, and we've got to work hard to maintain that. So when there are other people that I consider to be friends in my private life that, you know, you kind of fall out of contact with, I find it a bit weird that there's an expectation that I open up my private life to people I don't know, and that, I mean, I may care about them if I knew them, but I don't know them. So I'd prefer to, yeah, keep a little barrier there.
And just on that, I wonder, I'm picking up something.
That's way too deep for this podcast, by the way.
You took it there.
I know. I'm dirty on myself. Can we edit that out?
No. But on that, well, this is you don't need to dig deeper, but I remember.
That's like saying I'm really private, but can I tell you my deepest, darkest secrets?
No. You mentioned to me once that you had to feel like you create a persona on the field. And I was quite shocked. And the persona of you on the field is not you. And I wondered whether that skill then plays out as a coach as well. You've got your coaching persona that is not necessarily you. Are they similar or are they different?
No, it's different. It's easier as a coach for the simple reason that as a player, I was really clear on what I needed to do to be a good player, and that involved being aggressive, and you know, I played in defence. So for the most part, but actually that hasn't got much to do with it because I was similar, you know, when I played midfield when I started as well. I needed to be in a certain mindset, and Lee cultivated this with quite a few of us at Brisbane as well. Like we need to play on the edge, and to be frank, that's how I expect the Geelong players to play as well. But it has to be within your personality and your style. So Nigel Lappin, for example, at Brisbane, is pretty ruthless guy, unbelievably competitive, but a little introverted off the field, or he certainly was then. He's a bit better now as a coach. I shouldn't say better. He's a bit more extroverted. But if he was forced to go out there and try to belt blokes and sledge everyone, he just would have been a poor version of that sort of player. He needed to not say anything, run really hard and slice the opposition up with his skill. That was his version of ruthlessness. It was a little bit different with me, but it was a conscious decision too. It wasn't just this is how I have to play. It as I said, it was cultivated by the coach. Neil Barham's a great example. I'm not sure the age demographic of your listenership, but Neil, as I said earlier, was a GM of football at Geelong. He moved on to Collingwood, now he's a GM at Richmond. A lot of experience in the game, but back in the day when he played, he was brutal. If you can pull out the sensational 70s, or he might have even been the sensational 60s. But he just used the belt blokes. And he's a ruckman, really big guy. You know, and he said, I just played to the rules of the day. Which is what I reckon I did as well. And if I played today, I'd play differently because, you know, the rules have changed and the expectations, you know, around, I guess, health and safety have changed, and you've got to move with that. But Neil, he had the unique, in some ways, you either are unique or you're not, I guess. But I think he was unique of the day in that he was brutal and ruthless, and, you know, he used to punch guys when it was required, but is a gentle giant off the field, incredibly intelligent, articulate, really caring. I still believe to this day there are some players, depending on their skill level and their skill set, need to have a football persona, which is who you are when you cross the white line. But it doesn't have to impact the rest of your life. Just because you're a prick to play against doesn't mean you need to be a prick when you go home at night.
In terms of a bit of personal reflection on the senior coaching journey so far, you know, when you rocked up, commenced on day one, were there personality traits, not weaknesses, but traits that you had that you've had to evolve or manage that I guess have you've learnt to manage them over the course of the journey? And on reflection, I mean, how has that evolution taken place?
Yeah, I don't think it's unfair to call them weaknesses. I still have plenty of areas where I'm nowhere near as good as I could be. And I think it's good management, good leadership, if you think you've got critical weaknesses, to try to find people that, one, can help you with it, but probably more importantly, can actually do that sort of stuff better than you can. I'll give you a practical example. Because I'd only had 3 years as an assistant, I was not really that confident in my match day coaching. I felt like I needed to put a bit of work into that, and I'm much, much more clear on what constitutes, you know, effective coaching match day than I've ever been. But that took a lot of time to get there. And I think, you know, one of the again, it comes back to the support of Geelong. It was more about if we did have some holes there, that we didn't try to fill them with crap, you know, like if sometimes the best decision can be saying, okay, we'll just leave that alone altogether. And probably, you know, the part that, you know, I know myself well enough, and this is something that, you know, I don't think I'll ever get perfectly right, but I'm ultra competitive in some forums. In others, I'm not. You know, it's kind of like that idea that, you know, people are just, you're either competitive or you're not. I find I can kind of pick and choose a little bit, but when I'm in the moment and I really want to win, sometimes I really want to win so much that, you know, it can get in the way of good decision making. You know, to talk about influences, I'll just give you a quick story about a podcast that I listened to with John Wooden, who was the American college basketball coach. He's now passed away, but I think he did this interview when he was about 80. And he had an amazing record with UCLA and others. At one stage, I think won 80 out of 82 games. But he said on reflection, before they'd won their first title, he thought that he wanted to win it so badly that he almost wanted to win it too much. So I think you speak to a lot of people, especially fans, and when you play poorly or you get a bad outcome, and the media, I think, tip into this a little too easily, although they are at the disadvantage that they don't have the level of information we have. So the analysis becomes superficial, and invariably it resorts back to, you just got to try harder or you just got to be tougher. And it's just, I mean, I can't help but roll my eyes when I hear that. It's kind of like, we're talking about some of the best athletes in the country who are unbelievably committed to what they do. It's so complex these days, and you're saying it comes back to effort. They went out there and they just didn't quite try hard enough. Maybe, every now and again, maybe, because we're talking degrees, I know. It's not like they tried or they didn't, but it's just you've got to give everything you've got. Maybe some days it's not quite where it needs to be. But I would venture to say that there's a few more inputs than toughness and effort when it comes to executing in the big moment. I think, you know, the Geelong guys in the prelim final last year, we had a really bad quarter against Sydney. And for some people, the takeaway is, got to be tougher, got to try harder. Yeah, I can tell you, you know, I've analysed it pretty closely. There are things other than that at play. So back to John Wooden. He felt like, through that period, he just wanted a title so badly that he was trying too hard. And the question coming back was a really good one. So often you hear those sort of things, oh, yeah, okay, right, next questions. What do you mean? And what did that look like, trying too hard? well, it looks like let's just keep the players out on the court for another couple of hours tonight and let's keep doing this until we get it right. And he felt like it that manifested in overworked players going to games tired, not really liking what they were doing, feeling like every time they failed, they get hammered by the coach. And again, it's sort of one of my core principles. It's your fault first as a coach, not the players. There's nothing worse, in my opinion, or my experience as a player, when the coach comes in and kind of says, in as many words, how could you do this to me? How could you let me down? It's like, honestly, the coaches that say they're doing it for me are kind of in a dream world anyway. Like, not everyone completely dismisses self-interest. But John Wooden said, you know, it wasn't until he actually let go a little bit that he realised the most effective way, didn't involve wanting it more or trying harder necessarily.
And as an athlete, it's probably true as well. When you're in flow, when you're in that moment, you're not consciously, you know, you're just doing and it's unfolding. You've let go and it just happens.
Yeah, and it's not to say that as an athlete or even a coach that you won't have periods where you think, oh, I'm just not up for it today. But the good ones identify that and find a way to work their way through it. And sometimes if you've got the luxury of walking away and waiting 24 hours, then that's probably a good decision rather than try to force your way through it. But again, I would venture to say that, you know, the 800-metre runner who gets to the Olympics doesn't stand at the there's no blocks in the 800, but stand at the starting line and thinks to himself, just whatever you do, make sure you go as hard as you can. I kind of reckon that's implied.
I know we've got to bring some shape to this conversation. I feel like I could keep going forever. One of the last things I'm keen to ask you about is consultants, world of academia. Where does it fit in an elite program? Where does an external fit, if at all?
Yeah, it's something that we've experimented with. It's probably not the right word. We've ebbed and flowed a little bit with what we think is best. I guess the pro for consultants is that they can get a clearer perspective, so you avoid that frog in the boiling water analogy. The downside is they don't really know what's going on. So I think the really good ones have a way of asking the right questions without volunteering too much information themselves. And I reckon that's incredibly difficult because you tend to want to come in and either look for problems, because if there aren't too many problems, what's the point of you coming in? Or two, you come in and make observations based on what you've seen in 2 days a week or 2 days a month that are so superficial and probably wrong that they're worthless. So I think the consultants depend on what specific area they're in. So a consultant ruck coach, for example, makes a lot of sense. But a ruck coach who's also your midfield coach who's there for 100% of the time is a much better option. So Neil Baum, I'll paraphrase his view on this. When it comes to picking coaches, if you haven't got the people internally who can pick the coach, your people aren't good enough. Now, that sounds really disparaging of clubs and organisations that bring consultants in to be involved in the process, and I'm sure that there is a place for it, but don't defer to them completely. If your organisation, whatever it is getting a recruitment agency to bring in the best person for you with no involvement from you, I don't think you're going to last too long in that position. You've got to be able to back yourself in to pick the right people.
I know we're trying to bring some closure to this. I'm hoping this won't open a whole...
We've still got rapid fire, so I'm just preparing you.
I have a particular interest in high-performing families, and I think when you become a dad, you take an interest in, you know, what creating environments in your family where your kids can be successful. So I'm interested in what you might be able to share with us, about your upbringing that might have influenced the path that that you've taken.
Yeah, this is something that I've talked about a little bit, but not something I'm overly comfortable with, that side of things. So I'll try to give you a brief summary.
Yep.
I'm really proud of the fact that I was one of five kids who was brought up by our mum, basically. Our dad died. When I say our dad, my twin brother and I were eight when Dad passed away. Two older kids, one younger than the twins. But I'm really proud of the fact that we didn't really want for anything as kids. So, it was – I don't know how she did it. I don't know how we do it with two parents and one child, much less one and five. But coupled with that, Dad was in the army and flew planes and had a really interesting life. But he finished all that and the family had a news agency. Mum didn't really work in there. She was a teacher. But when Dad died, Mum took over the news agency basically. So I don't know, like the younger people wouldn't really understand news agencies these days, but back then they were kind of, you know, wrapping the papers at 4 a.m. and, you know, brutal hours. And so through all that, we went to St. Kevin's in Melbourne, good private school from grade five, played every sport you could imagine. Didn't really want for anything, but it was incredibly tough for Mum. So we got an unbelievable amount of admiration for her. How it shaped us, I mean, we're far from – sometimes when you talk about these things, it can come off as I'm the perfect specimen you see before you because of X. I'm flawed, so are my brothers and my sister. But it certainly wasn't because I think sometimes you hear, look, it was really tough and I'm the person I am because it was so tough. I didn't feel that. I understood that there were really difficult times for the family and in particular for Mum. But I think we've got a great understanding of, people that, lose people that are close to them, go through some difficulties in their childhood. But I also like to think that any success I've had is because Mum worked so hard to put us through a good school and spend time, I read to my daughter, not as much as I'd like to, but my wife certainly does. And we're influenced because our mums read to us and we think that made a difference, just little things like that. So I think a reasonable empathy for people. Mark bring there helps a little bit. But even aside from my family, I mentioned my best mates before. I'm so proud of the fact that there are probably five, six, seven of us that – all met, at the latest grade five. Some of them were grade three, and we're all best mates, and our wives are close as well. And it's kind of, I think it probably speaks to the fact that, we're a loyal group of people that sort of remember. No, when you say remember where you came from, it's kind of, I didn't come from the Bronx. Like, I'm not, Jenny from the block.
The fact you know that's impressive.
Yeah.
Okay, so rapid fire is just feel free to be brief. We're just going to fire a heap of a few questions at you, and we don't script this, and usually it comes off really poorly because Monty asks one question and then can't think of another one.
Yeah.
I'm too deep, that's why I like the long-winded, deeper questions.
Well, I can help you with those.
So my first question will be along the lines of at present, a sporting person that you utterly admire.
Steve Smith, and I'd love to come up with someone a little more obscure than, the most prominent sporting person in the country, the Australian cricket captain. But the thing I admire about him, and it's probably relating back to my experience, he took over a really difficult job at a young age and prospered as an individual. So the leadership, at least to this stage, appears to have had a synergistic effect on the way he plays the game. So I think, I think I know a bit about cricket and I really like it and I follow it, but I'm not an expert. It seems to me that he's a really good captain, but he's a better batsman because of the captaincy, and that doesn't always happen. I really admire that. He's because it wasn't as if, he's 35 when he took it on.
You mentioned some books, but can you pin it down to the one most influential book that has influenced you?
I'm so influenced by the Bible. Most recent ones.
Yeah,
the Bible.
Well, just an influential book.
Can I just, I'll just sort of reel off a few. Yeah. So the whole Michael Lewis series, I thought Big Short was fantastic. You know, there's that business side of it. But, he's taken some really bland subject matter and made it unbelievably interesting. So just the skill in that writing is impressive. But then going back to Moneyball and then The Undoing Project, the way that, you know, a storyteller can articulate some really complex ideas and even, you know, simpletons like me can understand it. They've been influential. There's a recent book, I think I'm pronouncing her name correctly, Brené Brown. She wrote a book called Daring Greatly, and it's about vulnerability and leadership. And I said to Sarah when I read it, I was like, people are going to think that people close to me are going to think that I've just parroted this idea because I've read her book. It resonated with me because I've always thought that this idea that, you know, the leader has to have all the answers is just so misguided. And, you know, especially with coaches, it's not like post-game, for example, it's kind of like, what happened? And the players are the same, especially when you lose. Most of the time, I'm sure it was your experience, it was definitely mine, when you lose as a player, kind of like, I'm not exactly sure what happened there. I can think of a few examples and a bit of a trend, but most of the time, if you're playing defence, you're 90 metres away from the ball, trying to work out exactly what happened is hard. So you come in and you kind of like, you want from the coach, oh, tell us what happened. Like, and can I tell you, 90% of the time, the coach is not exactly sure either, but there's this expectation that he'll articulate exactly why it all happened and probably why it was beyond his control. When the reality is a little bit of vulnerability, I'm not sure yet, but we'll work through it together, I think is an admirable thing. There were some books, Matthew Syed, I think that's how you pronounce his surname. He wrote Bounce, he wrote Black Box Thinking, really influential. I don't read a hell of a lot of fiction, but, you know, some of those books, they do, they're factually based, but they're interesting enough. There's enough storytelling in there to keep your attention. There's a book that I'm not through yet, but I find really interesting. Tim Ferriss was talking about it in a podcast I listened to recently, Anti-Fragile. I love that idea that, so it's kind of, it's not resilience. So fragile is when people criticize you, you're worse as a result, you're a bit fragile. Anti-fragile is not resilience, not as if you're immune to it. It's more that idea that I actually grow from the criticism. You know, because of your criticism, I'm better than you, like, or better than I was. I think, you know, there's some really interesting ideas explored in that book. But, yeah, 5 minutes after this, I'll go, oh, I should have told you really about that answer. One. But, yeah, there's a lot, yeah.
The moments in your life when it's pure enjoyment and it's not about performance. So what are you doing when you're just having fun?
Is this outside of the job, do you mean?
Yeah, if you have a life outside of the job.
But
what are you doing? Like, when you're completely switched off at ease, what are you doing?
Well, I know you don't like these answers, but given some mornings my daughter covers her eyes when I walk into the room and she told me the other morning, I don't love you anymore. And she's even started talking about like her old dad, like she had a dad in a past life that she liked better. So in the context of that kind of dismissiveness, when I come home and she's actually up for it, last night she was in the car with Sarah driving past the club and Sarah sent me a message saying, we're coming past soon, can you pop out? And I came out with a few other people behind me and she just, like, it was almost like I was the best dad in the world. And so I know that's a boring answer and you hate that sort of stuff, but I have to explain in the context that when you're actually, like, just hammered morning after morning, when you actually, you know, if your little girl likes you again, that they're pretty good.
I thought you might say something that included either red wine or a Daft Punk concert or something along those lines.
I was going to ask about the music.
Yeah.
This is my last one, by the way.
My musical tastes are eclectic, probably best described as that. Like, Tom, I'm into some sort of harder sort of electronic stuff at times, but Nick Warren sort of stuff, like, you know, I love Daft Punk. Daft Punk's probably the best. I got this question, I think, and I was doing a Foxtel interview the other day, and I said, what's your best concert or the best concert you've ever been to? And I said Counting Crows, which was awesome, but it was Daft Punk. It was Daft Punk at the Sydney My Music Bowl in Melbourne. That was pretty special. But, it's probably easy to talk about the stuff I don't like. I don't really like the stuff that's on the radio.
Mm. I've got a couple more.
There are a few exceptions. How long are we going to keep the man?
I know.
We're actually pushing this. It's awesome.
I know. In terms of moments that just stay with you during your football career, just one that stays with you that you find hard to let go of?
Again, it's probably the expected answer, but while Brisbane were really successful through the early 2000s, when I first started, we were terrible. And there were, you know, you talk about in football, you're going to have to endure more tough times than the good times, but all the tough times are worth it if you can reach the pinnacle. Never more evident in my experience at Brisbane. We just got beaten every week and it was really hard. And not only did we get beaten, but no one cared. It was kind of up in Brisbane. Like, it was just the game didn't matter, much less the team. And so I went through the first 4 or 5 years of my career thinking that, not even thinking about winning a premiership, it was just so hard to conceptualise that you didn't even bother. So when we won, it was like that feeling of disbelief. It was like, I haven't admitted this too often, but I went into the game kind of thinking, Essendon are a pretty good team. Like, this is a good effort to get here. Like,
crossed your mind.
Well, yeah, it did to an extent because, unless you're Michael Voss or, you know, Paddy Dangerfield, Joel Selwood, it's kind of like a lot of things have to go right here that I'm going to have no influence over. So it did cross my mind that, well, if a few things go wrong here, I'm not going to be able to stop it. I'll do my best, but I'm, you know, I hope it works out. But, you know, it's sort of that managing expectations a little bit, like, you know, if I want it so badly and, you know, I'll be just devastated if we don't get there. I think on some level probably wasn't that conscious, but on reflection, I think I had a bit of that in me. So when we won it, it was kind of like, my God, you know, did that really happen? And it was similar in 2011 with Geelong. You know, I've spoken a lot about how many things Geelong did well when I got there, but there was still a lot of work to be done to get to where. And even, you know, the week before the finals, Collingwood was still very much the team to beat. It was still like, this is all things are going to have to align here for us to get there. And as it is, they did. But it's sort of hard to believe. So that's kind of, I mean, I fundamentally believe that. Like, you can do a fantastic job, virtually everything you can, and you just don't have the luck, whatever that means, and it doesn't happen. So when it does happen for you, don't dismiss luck. Luck actually plays a role. If you think it doesn't, you've got, your arrogance levels have got out of control.
Jesus level. We did have a Matthew Pavlich on here, and we had a section called Punter's Corner where we just asked like all the questions that the Nuffies would ask.
Yeah.
So the last question I'm actually going to borrow from that, and it's, who's your favourite player at Geelong? And you have to have an opinion.
You should ask all those questions and get me to give the kind of cliched answer that I'd give.
Yeah,
In the media.
I was about to commend us for not actually talking about.
Well, we haven't talked about your twin brother, so we deserve some credit there.
I guess I brought him up, so it's my fault. But yeah, I'd love to give the real answer and then give the cliche. So the real answer, favourite player at Geelong. Oh, you've got to define that better.
No, I don't.
Yes. I'm going to have to give you a few answers then.
That's a good point. Okay, yep. That's a good point. The player who you'd like to spend time with more.
Yeah, well, I mean, in all honesty, it's hard to differentiate between a lot of them. Whether it's right or wrong, I do leave a little bit of space between me and the younger players. I think there's nothing worse than the 40-year-old trying to be best mates and wearing his cap backwards and, you know, bumping fists with the 17-year-old just trying to be cool. We've got a professional relationship, and if we end up being close, that's great, but let's make it real. So with that in mind, like Andrew Mackie's one that sticks out for me. I think he'll be, if he wants to, he'll be in footy until the day he dies, because he's smart, he cares.
I went to school with
him. He's a Sacred Heart.
Yeah, so when I should define smart, I don't have any idea how academic he is, but in terms of football sense, he's brilliant. And he'll have a great way about him, not even with the player-facing stuff or the people-facing stuff, which is an absolute strength. He's a relationship sort of guy, but he's got an eye for the game, and he's got an eye for what helps good environments operate. So I suspect that even if he doesn't do it all himself, he could be, if he wants to be, involved in the conversations around shaping culture and, yeah. And so my wife, Sarah, actually went to Sacred Heart as well and sort of knows Mac.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, you didn't tell me that. This is a Sacred Heart loving.
I try and steer away from the Sacred Heart.
Is Andrew Mackie still one of the great sledges? Because I've got this little anecdote. So we're playing Ray Sutton Shield cricket. So Mackie was actually probably a better cricketer growing up. And he got into us. He was captain of Adelaide Cricket Club, Ray Sutton Shield final, 13-year-olds. Him and Mark Cosgrove, Cozzy, got into a massive fight on the pitch where they both got reported. And I believe Cozzy said something like, "You'll be nothing, Mackie, when I'm playing for Australia." These words. And then, things
rest
played out.
History.
The rest is history.
So Mac played the long con, did he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he apparently is good. I mean, I never really heard him when I played, even though we did sort of – our careers overlapped a little bit. There are some great stories out there about him. The part that I admire is the fact that he's a fragile-looking man.
Yeah.
Like he
– He's built like a junkyard dog.
Well, if you saw him in the street, I mean, he's tall, but he doesn't look that athletic. His wife, Georgia Tate's great. Pleasure from highlighting that. So it's not something that he might be embarrassed about it, but he's heard it before, so I'm happy to repeat it. The people that sledge that can back it up with physicality, anyone can do that. But when you're a chance actually to get hurt because you're no chance to win if it becomes physical are the ones I admire. So he takes on some pretty significant targets and tries to beat them with his mind, which, yeah, I think I'm not sure it always works, but it's always entertaining.
Well, I think that's been an epic session, Chris. Really appreciate you. I never thought you'd come on the podcast. So to give up your time, and you are a private person, and to give us a glimpse into your world and your philosophies and thoughts on performance and coaching. I know that we could go on for another few hours, but you actually do have a game to get ready for this weekend out at Richmond Oval, a nice South Australian football ground. You'll enjoy that. So thank you, and we look forward to getting you on for part two in a few years' time.
Yeah, love to. Hopefully it's as enjoyable.
And why did you come on the podcast?
Well, you got me at a weak moment, is probably the answer.
He's regretting it now. He's been here 2 hours sweating it up.
Yeah. Well, I thought about that a fair bit, because when you asked me, I said yes straight away. I'd love to. But I think I was listening to a really interesting podcast and thinking,
I could be that guy.
Falsely, yeah. Maybe I could do that too.
There is something about the long form, the ability to talk freely and not be time-bound, I think, in a podcast sense, which
might help. And there's context.
Yeah.
We're not going to chop up your grabs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can edit this bit out if we're done, but I've come to the conclusion that I can't be critical of the 24-hour news cycle. And I do a press conference every week, and it's really for the TV cameras so they can get a 20-second grab, and it's – what's controversial, what the injuries are, blah, blah, blah. There's no substance to it at all. I think most of the good people in our game would actually take the time to talk about the issues offline and help those media guys understand a bit better if they actually took the time to ask. But I'm not sure that it's maybe I'm doing humanity a disservice. Maybe there are enough people that would actually enjoy listening to that sort of stuff, but I'm not trying to change the world.
On that note, Chris Scott, thank you.
Thanks for listening to our two-part interview with Chris Scott. This interview is syndicated with our sports podcast, Off Field, where we focus on the world of sport outside of the arena with the people who make it happen. Visit offfield.co, that's off-field.co, for links to subscribe. Thanks for listening to Rooster Radio. Connect with us at roosterradio.biz.